Welcome to Always On, 30 Years of Yes, a Jam Remembrance Project. This is Jovan Julien, the Storytelling and Alignment Coordinator at Yes. As would be expected of any 30-year-old, Yes has been through a series of transitions, evolutions, changes, and growth, culminating in the current era of Yes, the Jamily, that we have today. On this show and throughout the project, we'll be slowing down to remember and hear a story from throughout that history. We hope that you'll continue to join us as we slow down with founders, former and present staff members, Jamily, and others who have shaped and been shaped by and continue to say yes to this profound experiment in community. Shilpa, if you'd be so kind, could you introduce today's guests?
I can't think of a better way to start this 30th anniversary podcast for Yes than with this interview with Ocean Robbins. Ocean is one of the co-founders of Yes, and he started the organization when he was 16 years old, along with his friend Ryan Eliason, who hopefully we'll have at a later point in the show. Ocean took Yes through two decades of service and transformation. He started with the original school tour that reached over 500,000 students in the first 5 years, and then carried on to help develop the summer camps of Yes, which led to so many organizations around the country, environmental clubs, animal rights groups, and social justice organizations among young people. And then took Yes even forward to help develop the jams and create jams with partners all over the world. Ocean has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the National Jefferson Award for Outstanding Public Service and the Freedom's Flame Award, and so many other honors. And I can remember meeting Ocean at my very first jam, the World Youth Leadership Jam in 2002, and being not just touched by his incredible capacity to inspire and share beautiful words and feelings, but also by the humility and grace and curiosity and childlike innocence and joy that just he exudes every moment. So it's been my honor to be inspired by Ocean and guided. I think we had the most easy and sweet founder transition of all time. And I'm also so touched just to have Ocean as a friend in my life and a companion in the journey of this incredible work. So without further ado, love you, Ocean. Welcome to the show. So happy you're here with us today.
Oh my goodness. It's kind of mind-boggling. I'm so happy to be here, and honestly just so proud, so in awe, so grateful for what you and all the other people carrying Yes forward are creating with this magic. You know, when we look at the stars, we're seeing light that may have been created millions of years ago. Some of those stars aren't even in existence anymore, but that light is reaching us and lighting our world today. And so every act of good we do, every act of love we bring sends out ripples throughout the entire universe. And nothing ever actually ends. It just transforms and lands, in fact, like that light lands on us. And so I'm reflecting on that and feeling all the lights that have touched my life and that do touch my life and all the things that makes possible in terms of what I create and give and do. And my gratitude, my awe really that seeds that maybe I was blessed to be able to plant 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago are bearing such fruit today in lives and ecosystems and communities around the globe and are in fact now part of what I think is critical to humanity's recipe for survival in the generations to come. I'm just so grateful and humbled for that opportunity and so proud of you and everyone else involved for what you're doing to carry it forward.
It's really exciting to be having a chance to touch base. And I think maybe to start some of this conversation, I'd love to hear what was the star map like in 1990? At the beginning, what was alive in the world as YES started to form?
Well, in 1990, we were youngsters, and what struck me at that time, we had Nancy Reagan, who had just been telling our generation to just say no, and it seemed that young people needed something positive to say yes to and stand for. We needed visions of hope, and then, as now, there was a great deal of talk about sustainability and the future of the planet and what kind of world we would inherit. And we were just then beginning to learn about climate change and the potential impacts of it. And back then, we were saying, okay, we've got about a generation to turn everything around before it's too late. And what struck me then was that apathy was the thief of destiny. And what we couldn't afford was another generation just following the footsteps of what had gone before us. We had to become proactive. And ultimately, whenever we face suffering of any kind, I think we have a choice. Our heart either contracts away from it or expands to include it. And it struck me that for a generation of young people at that time, there was a lot of fear, a lot of cynicism about the future, and we wanted to activate a sense of hope and possibility, courage and potential. And so the star map that called me into action was the feeling that when we succumb to fear, when we succumb to hopelessness, when we allow the that which we find distasteful in the world to define us, then essentially we let fear have the last word, and we step away from what I believe is our actual calling and purpose in life. So then, as now, I believe every one of us has a purpose for living and a reason to be here. And my whole life, I've been asking, how do I be worthy of that purpose in my life? And how do I help activate others to do what they were born to do? And so for me, YES was born initially as a national speaking tour to try to mobilize young people to say, hey, let's do something. Let's take action. Let's be part of the solution. Let's not just, wallow in misery and, or perpetuate the status quo. And it's kind of poignant to think that our hopes and dreams of activating a revolution didn't fully come to pass, at least not yet, in the mass scale. But I know that every life we touched mattered. And literally, I meet people today sometimes who saw me speak in their high school assembly and it changed their life. It changed the way they eat. They started an organization because of that experience. And so I feel gratitude for that. So for years, we did this national tour, as you know. And then the star map kind of changed at a certain point. And we realized, oh my gosh, we're like scattering seeds from airplanes. We're touching hundreds of thousands of people, but who knows what actually lasts and what actually sustains? And maybe we need to focus on the soil. Like, how do you create the conditions where things germinate and good things spread and grow rather than just scattering seeds from airplanes? Because the reality is, even if a seed that we scattered happened to sprout, it was because the soil was ready for it. And when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. So how do we create the conditions for people to be more ready to transform? And so that led to the birth of YES Camps, which became a big focus for a while, working with young environmental activists and leaders. And then, of course, over the years, we realized that we had to redefine the environment to include people as well as the planet, to recognize that social justice, human rights, sustainability, freedom, opportunity, faith were all part of our environment as well. And so the jams became a chance to really bring people together from very diverse places and backgrounds to create transformative conversations. And that became essentially an answer to the same question in my heart, which was, how can I be a part of the healing that the world needs right now? And how can I play my part? And what is my part? And for me, the jams became the next step in that journey. And that eventually led to what YES is today.
I love that question. I just want to like underscore it because I think it's something that I know that still is such a live question in every jam and in every person is how can I contribute? How can I be alive to what is the healing of the world right now? What does it need right now? And I hear that all the time, and people both
recognizing the answer and wanting to really live fully and broadly and deeply into that,
Yeah.
as well as not knowing and seeking guidance and seeking support to figure that out, and everything in between. And so there's something really beautiful just to name that question again. And yeah, for all the people listening out there, I just hope there's this moment to just sit with that for a moment. How can I contribute? How can I be alive to the healing that is needed right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are more than 8 billion parts to play in the healing of our world. You know, every one of us has a niche, has a contribution to make, and they're all completely unique. I mean, of course we can learn from each other, but you know, your particular purpose is distinct. The people you love, the gifts you have, the dreams you have, the what lights you up is yours to discover. I think one of the things that kind of breaks my heart and the world right now is how many people are living lives of quiet desperation, are feeling the sense of fundamental emptiness, purposelessness, working jobs they don't love, if they have jobs at all. And where just sort of survival and coping becomes the goal of life. And I think that wherever we are, whatever hardships we're facing, whatever heartbreaks we're facing, whatever challenges we're facing, we all have some way to become worthy of, to become stewards of the love in our hearts and to become embodiments of it. And so my hope is that we can all participate, not just in giving our gift, but actually in helping others give theirs as well. And that's the beauty of it, is that anytime any of us steps into our own liberation, I think we help create a liberatory world, a culture, a climate in which others do so as well.
Thanks for that reflection. Thanks for dropping into that question. One thing that's sort of coming up for me, or I'm wondering about, is thinking about the organization as, you know, this 30-year-old entity. I know a lot of folks speak about Saturn returns and other things around the 28th to 30. I don't know the exact mechanisms, but as someone who's 31 right now, so I was born right before this organization, you know, thinking about my life, I'm wondering about what were some of the key lessons of its birth, its young childhood, its adolescence. What were the key learnings that occurred at that time? What were those? Maybe sometimes they're fall on your ass moments. Sometimes they're like, oh, wow, I can, I know how to run really fast and I'm learning how to move my legs and cook a meal or whatever it was. What were some of those learnings and lessons that helped to change or evolve the organization in the early years?
You know, we did some crazy stuff. We were like we were just naive enough to not know what the heck we were doing and just bold enough to try it. And somehow we survived, you know, but like, I mean, having a group of teenagers driving across the country in a van, you know, looking back, I'm surprised any of our parents let us do that. You know, some people had literally just gotten their licenses and they're driving 3,000 miles, you know, and, you know, but the biggest lesson, I think, at the outset, other than learning to change the oil in the van, which we learned the hard way after the engine blew up 3 times, was that the environment is everything that surrounds and affects us, and it means different things to different people. So we were in communities where the environment was trees and sky and, you know, saving the rainforest and stopping climate change. And we were in communities where the environment was gangs and concrete and, you know, trying to get home from school without getting shot. And as we traveled, I saw that to be an environmentalist meant to be activated on behalf of that which surrounds you, to be a part of the solution instead of part of the problem. And that really means different things in different communities. And so the Yes Tour started off as an all-white touring troupe speaking in school assemblies, and we got very different receptions in, you know, Los Altos, California than we did in Compton. And as we traveled and spoke in communities where our message didn't resonate in the same way, it was really humbling. Our first assembly in an inner city school, it was actually our first assembly we did at all, was at Galileo High School in San Francisco, and they had metal detectors on the way in, and we were in a gymnasium that we didn't know yet how to ask for proper technical support. So we had a battery-powered megaphone for our assembly, and we were passing it between us. And early on, I made some comment about how McDonald's was destroying the rainforest. And someone said, "Are you saying we can't eat at McDonald's?" And I said, "Yes, McDonald's is very bad for your health and very bad for the planet." And there was this big boo that went up from the crowd. And they started throwing paper airplanes at us. And, you know, we had a little product sales table to sell books and resources at the end. And we didn't sell anything, but we did have some stuff stolen after the assembly. And we felt like we hadn't reached anybody. I mean, they were literally talking during it. Just ignoring us completely. And it was a really humbling moment. And I think the journey then became, well, how do we find a message that is more resonant to the totality of humanity? And eventually that meant we had to change who was on stage and the stories we were telling and the ways we were bringing it forth, and do the deep inner work to learn about our own relationships to race and class and power and privilege and how we all fit into those puzzles, right? Because the reality is none of us created the systems of oppression and violence that perpetuate our times, but we all participate in them in one way or another. We're all impacted by them. And the reality is that the more people have been personally impacted by them, the more they have by definition had to think about them, face them, learn about them. So I don't think understanding issues of race and oppression is really an option for a lot of people in communities of color. But for people like me from a white background, it's optional, or at least it felt optional at the time. And I had to say yes to that, to undertake that journey, to discover my sense of place, culture, history, relationship to the world around me. How have people like me impacted people in other communities around the world that aren't like the one I grew up in? And what is the impact of that today? And what is my responsibility for that? And how do I show up in that? Not from a place of guilt or shame, but from a place of curiosity and humility and ultimately resolve, dedication, compassion, and courage. And so having those conversations, being willing to step into that fire, and eventually creating spaces at JAMS where we would, again, step into issues of race and class and power and gender and religion and nationality and not know what the outcome was going to be. Be willing to say, we value truth more than a facade of niceness, and we're willing to go where the truth leads us. And sometimes that meant some really uncomfortable conversations when people speak truth that, you know, as a facilitator, you might be like, oh my God, I wish that hadn't been said right now. That just poisoned the air, you know? But then finding how a community can respond to that in a way that builds real trust, not the trust that's based on I'll be nice and you'll be nice and none of us will ever break the facade of a smile, but the trust that's built on we're actually going to speak truth and care about each other and hang in there to the other side to discover what's here for real between us. And out of that, we saw real relationships getting built. And so for me, the epic transformation of 20 years of directing Yes was my own personal journey of learning how I fit into the world, what my place is in the world, and ultimately how to be an embodiment of more love, more courage, and more truth, and to build relationships on real ground. I'll never forget meeting Malika in 1999 was when we met. And as she came to a JAM, and I remember she was from Selma, Alabama, and, you know, had never had a white friend before. And in a way, I'll be honest, I hadn't ever really had an African-American friend before. I mean, I'd had people I would have called friends, but never like that we went really, really deep. And I saw Malika and I said, oh my gosh, I asked if we could have some time. And I said, I just respect you so much. I think you're an incredible human being. And I want to be honest that I'm afraid a little bit in reaching out to you that I could perpetuate racism. I could say something wrong because there's so much I don't know. And I just want you to know that I'd like to be your friend. And I'm a little awkward about knowing how to. And she said, where I come from, white folks never talk like that. And the humility and the willingness to reach out makes me think maybe we could be friends. And so we just started talking, and we started talking from a place where there was room to make mistakes. And there was a love and a respect that grew deeper than that was underneath all of the discoveries and the experiments of just learning how to be friends, you know? And I'm so grateful for all the people that had so much patience with me. And I have had so much patience with me over the years to help me learn.
Yeah, for those of you listening, I invite you to check out the our next installment with Kumba and Malika as well. They'll touch a little bit on their journey to that JAM in 1999. Malika attended it first. They had a conversation. I think they maybe were both invited.
Yes.
There was a conversation about who would end up going. They go a little bit into that. And then the sort of multitude of folks who they've sent towards the jam since then, in the ways that it's impacted their life and lives. I'd love to hear a little bit maybe about how you see the jam playing out in your life today. You've certainly spoken to the personal transformations that were inherent in being in leadership of this space for 20 years. And I'm wondering, in this intervening 10 years between the 20th year and now, how do you feel or see the jam continuing to impact, evolve your life?
So for me...
And not just the jam, I'd say also just all your leadership,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. So for me, at one point I felt that the best way I could contribute to social justice, as I recognized the gap in opportunity and resource and freedom that so many communities were facing, was to go to communities that were hurting and struggling, marginalized communities, and try to bring something different there. And then I got the message from some people in the Jamily that said, you know, don't try to save us or fix us. Like, look at the people you have the easiest time reaching. Look at the audiences you can touch and help them change, because that's where your greatest impact might come from. And, you know, I don't think there's one formula for, you know, people should always just stay in the communities they started in. But it struck me that perhaps I could be most effective reaching people who would respond the most effectively to me. And I had this sense of calling to reach the mainstream, to reach bigger audiences. I felt like the jams were this incubation for culture that could change the world. And I wanted to help take some of that culture out on a broader scale to more people. It's almost like jams are like a laboratory for a healing salver, a healing, you know, healing medicine. And I wanted to see if I could share a piece of that with as large an audience as possible. And so in 2012, after moving on from Yes and trying to figure out what the heck I was going to do for a little bit, I knew there was something that was going to be large scale. And so ended up launching Food Revolution Network. And we've grown to be over 500,000 members. And we have 20,000 visitors a day on our blog and send 100 million emails a year. And, you know, we're reaching a lot of folks. It still feels, honestly, like there's a lot more potential. But the goal is to change the food system. And that's not a small task. we want healthy, ethical, sustainable food for all. And what I'm finding is that there's a kind of human relationship skill, kind of awareness of impact and power and how I hold power that's very present in me that I had no clue about before all the work and all the learning and all the growth I did in the years in the Yes community. And it helps me to be such a better leader. You know, we have so many models of leadership in the world, I think, that are self-serving, that are even violating, whether intentionally or not. And I'm interested in a model of leadership that is super strong in integrity, where I know who I am and what I stand for, and I'm conscious of how I hold power in relationship to the communities I touch and impact. I think the other piece that's interesting is that right now the demographic I'm reaching is predominantly white, predominantly middle class, predominantly North American. And I want to keep seeding social justice, consciousness, awareness of the larger world we live in into that community. So people enter the work I'm doing because they care about their health, because they don't want to get a heart attack, because they don't want to get Alzheimer's. And in the process, they're learning about how food is impacting farm workers and farmers and animals and ecosystems and rainforests and social justice and indigenous tribes. And they're being steered towards food choices that will make an impact on the world we share, so that there will be less carbon in the atmosphere, so there's more water and topsoil for future generations, so there's more rainforest standing for indigenous people, so that there's a healthier food economy, and we're promoting things like healthier school lunches and, you know, how we can change food systems and get rid of tax subsidies for junk food. I mean, Twinkies has 14 subsidized ingredients, and, you know, virtually no subsidy goes to broccoli or nuts and seeds or legumes or, you know, the foods we should be helping people eat more of. And so what does that mean? It means that at the end of the day, the poor are condemned to nutritional disasters if they can't afford anything else. And what government is subsidizing is junk. And so I'm trying to shift that, raise awareness of that. So And I think that that sort of burning passion for social justice and the need to keep bringing it into every presentation I give, every book I write, is something that it was instilled in me at a very fundamental level through all the years in Yes. So I'll never be the same in that way. And even so, there's inquiry that needs to happen about, like, how do we reach more diverse communities in our own mission and work? How do we not just help white people be more conscious of social justice, but quite frankly, how do we not widen the health gap along race and class lines? You know, if all we do is help rich white people who are privileged to be healthier, we are widening the gap between, and that's not what I want my legacy to be. So I'm really continuing to burn with those questions. And I think one of the things Yes helped me to do was to live with complicated questions without needing to find cheap, fast answers, to be able to live into them and explore and inquire from different perspectives and angles and keep going with that, never to settle and get complacent, but at the same time to find peace in that inquiry.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that word. I'm wondering, or I guess, as a, not a final question, but as maybe a way to, I have a request of you, I guess, as someone who has carried story and culture and history of, Yes, this organization and community, 20 years of it inside yourself. I wonder if there are any particular messages from then, from that, those communities, that version of yourself who was alive here from 1990 to 2010. I'm wondering, are there any particular messages that are rising up from you that want to be told forward, that want to be told to the community now as it figures out how to move into its next 30 years, or maybe just its next 10 or 1 year?
So what I want to say is that certain things are eternal and certain things change guaranteed. I mean, we're all going to die. The world's going to change radically. Look at how it's changed. However old you are, I guarantee you the world has changed in your lifetime, like significantly. You know, when I was a kid, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't even have computers. You know, there was no internet. And you know, when my parents were kids, you know, cars were a bit of a novelty, you know? And so what is the world going to be like in future generations? Quote, good or quote, bad, you know? We don't know. But what we do know is that there's something in us that's eternal, that's there from the day we're born to the day we die. There's a witness, there's a presence. And I believe that all of the love we share and all of the questions we ask live on and are part of that eternal self. It's like, it's what I believe we'll live on even when we move from this world. You know, I believe that something of our essence is eternal. And so the more uncertain things become in the world, the more chaos and, you know, radical transformation takes place around us, the more what's eternal, what's unmovable matters, I think. And so when I reflect back on all the different people I've been, all the different things I've done over the years, from the national tour to summer camps to jams to now Food Revolution, like there's something very different about all those expressions, but there's something completely constant, which is kind of like, how can I help? How can I express love? How can I be true to my purpose? How can I help others be true to their purposes? How can I create more integrity in my life and in my ecosystem and on my planet? And those questions live in me. I believe they will always live in me. And so I guess I invite everybody listening right now to explore, what are the questions that live in you? What's eternal in your being? And how can you presence that? No matter how much changes, I mean, a compass points north no matter what's going on the ocean. And so what's your compass? What's your truing ground? And the more crazy the storms are, the more important it becomes to keep returning, keep breathing, return to your breath, return to your peace, return to the still small voice inside that frankly doesn't care whether you live or die. Frankly doesn't care about all the things that we think are so important. It just is. It's just a witness. And I believe that lives in all of us. And so I think it's profoundly important to remember that we're not the stuff we do, we're not the stuff we accumulate, we're not even the stuff we've accomplished. We just are. And to me, that presence gives us the willingness, the courage, or it looks like courage on the outside. To me, it really is more willingness to do what needs to be done.
Ashay, thank you for that. Thank you for your willingness to figure out your compass, and to follow it, to share love and truth, and to grow in your own integrity, and for the ways that that revolves or propagates into my life and into the life of the jam and into the life of Yes, and for your continued engagement with it. I just want to make sure that as folks listen, they don't think or believe that it was 20 years and then away. Throughout my own journey
No.
over the last 5 years with the organization, you've been ever present. So I just want to make sure that I acknowledge and name that as a storyteller. It's important, I think, to make sure the context is set properly. So
Thank
just
you
want
so
to do
much.
that. And share many gratitudes for your finding the time today to sit down and to record story.
Thank you both for and all for carrying this forward. And everybody listening right now, you're part of this now too. So tag, you're it.
Tag, you're in. And make sure to listen to episode two, where you'll hear more about how Shilpa, through her connection to Kumba, ended up at her first gym. Excited and grateful for both the y'all presence and for everyone who's listening to our voices wherever you're sitting. I hope that whatever questions are alive for you are coming to the forefront, that you're finding ways to share those in integrity with those around you and help them shape your lives, and that maybe you'll reach out either to the Jamily or to myself and find yourself at a jam sharing a question in a circle in the future. Yeah, with gratitude and love and joy, I say goodbye to Shilpa and to Ocean and to you all, and we hope to hear from you soon. All original music was composed and recorded by Austin Willis. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Always On. This is Jovan Julien, your host. I'm excited to present our next episode with Kumba Torre and Malika Sanders Fortier. We'll share about some of the early iterations and evolutions that brought us from the first jams to now.